inside the world of a substitute teacher. The call comes early in the morning from the school secretary. Can you teach second grade today? You arrive early and read over the subplans the teacher has left you, and then the fun starts. In his account of working for 28 days as a sub in a main school district, New York Times best-selling author Nicholson Baker offers a detailed diary of the controlled chaos of the public classroom, and in the process captures the daily dose of drama, boredom, frustration, humor, and heartbreak that accompanies what we call learning. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll talk with Baker about his book titled Substitute, Going to School with 1,000 Kids, and about the questions it may be raising in the ongoing national conversation about how we can make our schools better. And as always, we want to hear from you. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Admit it, when you were in school and heard that there was a substitute that day, the game changed. It's not an easy job. You may not know the kids or the material, and your authority can be aggressively challenged. But what's it really like? Our guest today has written a book about his experience and observations as a substitute teacher in Maine. Nicholson Baker is the author of 10 novels and 5 works of nonfiction, including Double Fold, which won a National Book Critics Circle Award, and House of Holes, a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. His best-selling book, Substitute, just came out in paperback, and it's the focus of our conversation today. As always, we want to hear from you as well. Have you ever been a substitute teacher? Do you have questions about what it takes to be a public school teacher in Maine? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Nick, welcome to Maine Calling.
I'm so happy to be on your show. Thanks.
Our phone number, again, is 1-800-399-3566, and we'll take calls in a few minutes. Let's start at the beginning here. The book opens with an account of your experiences attending a series of evening substitute teacher training courses in this Maine school district, which you call RU66. The names have been changed here to protect the anonymity of the people that you're writing about, sometimes in great detail, by the way. Mm-hmm. Some of the other people in this sub-training class are there to maybe earn a few extra dollars, or some are using it as a way to get classroom experience toward becoming a full-time teacher. Why were you there?
I think I was there because I thought I wanted to write a book about American education, and I had watched both my own kids go up through Maine public schools, and I felt I had a lot to say about it. But then I realized that I knew absolutely nothing, that I was a complete imposter because I didn't have any experience standing in front of little people and trying to get things across to them. The great knack that teachers have, I hadn't even tried it. And I realized, actually, the other thing was that both my kids in the school district we were had a couple of substitutes they kind of liked. And I thought, well, that gives me hope, because when I was a kid, I always felt sorry for the substitute teachers. They were treated terribly. But they kind of liked some of them. So I thought, well, just do it within the system. See what it's like to be a person who does what is sort of on the lowest rung of the ladder. What can you learn from that vantage point?
And in those classes, the instructor at the end kind of says, well, who's interested? And there's a show of hands or something. And a few of the people who had attended decided that it was not for them. And in fact, it isn't really for everyone, because it's a really tough job.
It is a tough job. It is tough. It's funny, because being a teacher, the job is to send knowledge across this mysterious river into other people's minds. It's very difficult to teach teaching. The only way to teach teaching is to get in there and see moment by moment what works and doesn't work. It's a real apprenticeship. So a lot of people find out that they can't. And it's being a substitute is harder, actually, than being the regular teacher, because you have the normal sort of ladders of authority and punishment aren't available.
Did you have any preconceptions about what it would be like based upon either your kids' experiences or your past experience or portrayals of substitute teaching in film or anything?
My son said, don't do it. Just don't do it. They will destroy you. And I knew that I think part of me wanted to be destroyed. I think it's good for the character to be reminded of what it's like to be in a situation in which there are no familiar points of reference. And that's what it's like. And in a substitute, you are in a tiny old town canoe and you don't know the river system and you don't know where you don't even know what direction the river is flowing. You're just there and you're trying to get somewhere and you don't know exactly where you're trying to get. It's hard. It's really difficult, and you have to make it work right from the beginning. And I knew initially that probably the first number of days weren't going to go very well, and in fact they went horribly, you know, just as I thought.
But you were given, I guess, pretty good. Would you say you were fairly warned about or advised?
Well, you know, there is a shortage of substitute teachers, but there is also, at least in the district that I was dealing with, quite a good course that I could take. And the people who came in, there were principals and guidance counselors from the various schools, from the elementary school and the middle school and the high school. And they were really smart and helpful, and they had a lot of wisdom that they quickly got across. And we sort of took notes. And I think that they, especially, there was one, I thought, really, really smart and good principal of an elementary school who just said, look, you know, kids, they want to be funny. They want you, it's okay to laugh at their jokes. And you got to treat them like people, like they're your own son or grandson or niece or nephew. Treat them like people. And take what they say seriously, and they will be eating out of your hands. Now, it's not quite that easy, but she was right. You know, she was, I think, the best, most gifted person I ran into in the whole school district. And I felt very privileged to have had this very experienced teacher, who is now the principal of the school. Just being able to sit and listen to her explain what it was like.
Early on in the training, as I recall, you were told by someone that as a teacher, you might be the only person that some of these kids have that care about them, that sincerely asks them how they're doing, that encourage them, that are kind to them.
Right.
Did that change your Does that help change your perspective about what you're really there to do and to get through the frustrations?
I think it's a very powerful thing always to keep in mind, is that you don't know, as a substitute teacher, you don't know anybody's backstory. You don't know who is from a house that is in chaos and who is from a kind of Tony place where they keep horses. You have no notion. You just have these little people or middle-sized people, sometimes huge people that look like linebackers. But you have people and you don't know where they come from. You don't know anything about them. And in fact, that's kind of a helpful thing because you, unlike other teachers, you're not prejudging anyone. The person who is the class bad person, I'm usually warned, but I try to just take him or her in as if I knew nothing. So I was a person just sort of approaching the whole thing as if it's a tabula rasa, a blank slate. Here they are, no backstory.
We'll read an excerpt that describes a couple of the characters, if we call them that, the kids, in a moment. But I want to bring in Chris Olson, who is a substitute teacher and retired middle school teacher. Chris, are you there?
I am.
Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
tell me, Let's get your perspective on being a substitute teacher. Why do you do it?
I do it because it allows me to continue doing something that I really, really enjoy doing without having to do all of the other stuff that goes with teaching, after school, meetings, paperwork, and all of that.
Yeah,
I just enjoy being with the students.
So you get to do the fun part and not the
fun part.
Yeah, the fun part.
right. But it allows me to do it on my own time.
Sure.
You know, when it fits into my schedule.
And as a former the experience as a classroom teacher, though, do you think you have a different view of substitutes before than you do now that you're being a sub?
I don't think my views have changed as far as my expectations. I kind of try to do now as a substitute what I expected a sub to do for me when I was out, when I was a full-time teacher.
Yeah. I was wondering whether if you think that whether parents and policymakers who are often critics of the education system might take a different view if they were, say, required to sub at least a few days in their life. Would it change, do you think, the way that they look at it and talk about it?
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
No, I
think
so. You know, fortunately, I worked in a district and subbed in a district where, you know, people still know who I am. And sure. So I feel like I'm highly respected for that reason as a sub.
Sure. So you you know how to control a crowd, I'm guessing, with all of your experience there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Chris. All right. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate you joining us. Chris Olson is a retired Falmouth Middle School science teacher and is now a substitute teacher. Nick Baker, I wonder if we could read a little excerpt from your book here, which gives a good sense of the experience of reading it, which is in, I think as you described it, sort of slows down time a little bit. It lets us spend a little time on each person and reflect upon them and meet them in a way that we couldn't do if we were just even experiencing it in the first place. But if you could read a little section and describe where we are here as we begin this.
Sure. Well, the first day I was sent was sent to be a substitute in a special ed math class, and I had to. One of the interesting things, you have to sort of suss out what level each student is at, and who people are, because sometimes there's sort of secret rules that people who aren't really part of a class can be in a class. So there's this whole flow that you have to enter into and not disrupt. You have to kind of accept the fact that you're an interloper who has everything to learn. So anyway, I took some attendance and I read what they were supposed to be doing. They were supposed to be doing some algebra too. And then the bonger bonged again and some new students showed up. These were chattier. People up to then would have been very, very quiet. People were waking up now. I met a kid named Clyde who was interested in trucks and wore a plaid shirt and a baseball hat. He said he made good money by plowing people's driveways. His grandfather had gotten him a truck, which was completely rusted out. You could see the road through the floor, he said, and it wouldn't pass inspection. So his father found him another truck on Craigslist for $1,500 that he was happy with. Clyde told me that it was tricky to plow driveways right now because the ground was starting to thaw. If it's a paved driveway, then you can just drop the plow down on the asphalt. But if it's a dirt driveway, you don't want to rip up the surface by plowing too deep. You get a feel for it after a while, he said. So this is a kid in remedial math who has so much knowledge. You know, that's part of the thing, is every kid has a world of knowledge that they're bringing to school that often the school doesn't know about and doesn't value particularly, but it's part of that kid's life. Another kid named Seamus came in, quietly amused young man, also wearing a baseball hat, turned out to have a girlfriend named Rianne. Rianne was round-faced and pale and wore very tight black pants and a black and pink striped shirt, and she worked at McDonald's. She'd worked until 3 in the morning the night before, closing the store. "I don't sleep," she said. That was how she got through high school. she said, by not sleeping. She leaned against Seamus with her eyes closed, while Seamus looked at videos on his iPad. Then Seamus's friend Artie appeared, a loud, jokey storyteller who liked to get as close as he could to dropping the F-bomb without actually dropping it. I was like, what the fudge? He was stocky and handsome, and he spent his time trying to find good-looking bathing beauties on his iPad from websites that weren't blocked. He was supposed to be doing a geometry worksheet. Then a person comes in and tries to get him to do the geometry worksheet, and things move forward. He actually gets his name on the top of the page, I think.
This segment is interesting because, A, it begins with the bonger bonging.
Yeah.
And this is about the atmosphere, first of all,
right,
in the school, which is this sort of constant, unexpected noise that followed by directions of some sort, which really creates an environment that you, I guess, reflect upon.
I mean, I think what we're dealing with is the reality of how do you keep hundreds of kids going to different classrooms all day long. Obviously, bongers have to bong, but there is a state of constant interruption, and it is really hard to think sometimes with the number of announcements that come over the PA system. I'm certainly not the first person to talk about this. People have made eloquent pleas to just let's have less stuff on the PA system, please, because, you know, we're all in these hot boxes filled with human people trying to do work, and everybody's being pestered to do work. So if there are things blaring out over the PA system, so those drove me crazy. On the other hand, I was fascinated by them. What was it that the school believed was so terribly important that they had to send it out loudly to every student in the school? Well, it was usually people who were doing well. These were our five people who, you know, won the Mathletes Challenge. These were the people who went to Portland to do the fancy special competition. And so it's the people who are doing well. And wouldn't you like to be one of those people? Well, you know, most people are not those people. And the people that I was dealing with often as a substitute ed tech, a person taking the place of someone who was supposed to help people who were struggling, were the people who never were mentioned on the PA system except to say for some disciplinary reason.
We also learn in that segment that we meet a couple of the kids. Clyde, as you mentioned, who is wise in his way but really not learning much in this environment.
Mm-hmm.
Rianne, who has been up till 3 o'clock the night before, is exhausted. That's another theme in here. The kids are distracted, uninspired, and exhausted, which is not a great setup. And that's part of this mix too, right? Mm-hmm. That's part of what makes this complicated.
That's the beautiful cocktail of, especially of high school, is sleep deprivation and intense pressure to learn things whose meaning in life is not terribly clear, like Algebra 2. Algebra 2 is a brilliant construct that there, but most of the kids who I saw were getting no intellectual pleasure from it, and on the contrary, were just being beaten down by it. But I don't want to give the impression that the life of the high school student or the middle school or the grade school student, all these kids, was, you know, this unending torment. What I took away from it was that, well, that kids are very, they're very shrewd and they're very funny and they're trying to find a way to get through the day that is entertaining in some way and that allows them to learn something that they actually value.
Was it Clyde that gave you the bit of wisdom about good kids and bad kids?
Yes, he said. He said, you know, sometimes the bad kids are the good kids. I don't know, it's something very simple and pithy, and I drove back after that first day thinking, I did very little for that, you know. I guess it was $65 or something for a day of substitute teaching. But I've learned something, and the guy was wise before his time. And you know this about Maine. I mean, there is a certain kind of wise kid often has a baseball hat on, and he's not going to get angry, but he's not necessarily going to do the work. He's just going to be himself, you know?
And he said there are good kids and bad kids, and sometimes the bad kids are the good kids.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. All right. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. Your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to the public, and Skudik Institute, advancing ecosystem science and learning for all ages through a partnership with Acadia National Park. SkudikInstitute.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the risk of nuclear war with North Korea. We talk with New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, who spent 4 days in Pyongyang last month, where he says talk of nuclear war is everywhere, including on TV and billboards. We'll talk about why this has become an especially risky time and where it might lead. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock. And tonight at 10 on Maine Public Television, a special live program giving a never-before-seen tour of the underwater resting site of the USS Indianapolis. Lost for 72 years, the wreckage of the U.S. Navy cruiser, the Indianapolis, was located just last month 18,000 feet below the surface of the Philippine Sea. The ship was hit by two Japanese torpedoes and sank in 12 minutes on July 30th of 1945, which led to the greatest loss of life at sea from a single ship in U.S. Navy history. The Indianapolis was returning from a secret mission to deliver the first atomic bomb used in combat when it was sunk. USS Indianapolis live from the deep. That's tonight at 10 on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the role of a substitute teacher. With me in the studio, Nicholson Baker. He's an award-winning author whose book, Substitute, Going to School with 1,000 Kids, is about being a substitute teacher in Maine and about the state of public education today. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Bill Webster. He's superintendent of Lewiston Public Schools. Bill, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
We've done some reporting on this subject, so I know what the answer to this is. But is it hard to find substitute teachers in your district?
Most definitely, and I think this is a problem across the state of Maine, if not the nation. We have almost full employment in the state, and people that want jobs already have them. So it's been a challenge for sure.
So how are you dealing with that? I mean, the conventional thought would be in this world of supply and demand that you either lower the standards that you'll accept or increase the pay. Are either of those in play?
Well, for better or worse, they both are. We have increased our sub pay. Sub for teacher now can get $100 a day. Perhaps we need to increase that further, although we're higher than most, if not all, our neighboring districts. In addition, we have, and I hate to use the word lower our standards, but we're considering substitutes that in the past maybe we wanted someone with at least some college background, if not a diploma. We're even looking at some high school graduates, given our emergency situations, particularly those that we know have classroom experience and the ability to both motivate and help with the education of students.
You would still have to maintain the same rigors around background checks and that sort of thing.
Most definitely. And I just want to say that substitutes are really a critical cog in the wheel of education. I echo many of the comments that your guest has said, because if they aren't there, if they aren't present in the classroom, then it's going to impact an ed tech perhaps that has another responsibility, or a teacher may need to cover two classes. So an absence of substitute can make all the difference in terms of what's happening in a school. And the presence of substitute, particularly those, and we have some that are, we call them permanent building substitutes, they're there every day and have wonderful relationships with students and are really critical to helping those students be successful.
So from an administrator's point of view, how well does the system for bringing in substitutes and using substitutes in the classroom working? Is there a way, do you think, to improve how that works?
Well, Lewiston may be unique. One of the things we're looking at, we have a number of immigrants and refugees, some of whom have teaching certifications from their native country. They may not have completed a transcript review in order to get a work permit here. So that's an avenue that we're increasingly looking at. And presently we have roughly 100 substitutes on our rolls, and I believe that over 20 of them represent people from that population. We need to continue looking. We need to be more creative in how we recruit. Most of us old timers, you know, we're used to placing ads in the newspaper. We now do that online and have for many years. But I think we need to be more involved in the use of social media. We need to be more involved in looking at other recruiting avenues, including firms that specialize in that and perhaps do a better job than what we do in the schools.
All right, Bill, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Bill Webster is Lewiston Public Schools superintendent. Nick Baker, there aren't a lot of you don't deliver a lot of prescriptions for what we need to do in the schools, but you do have some clear thoughts around a few certain areas, learning standards, for example, a Common Core. There are times in the book where you don't devote, you know, paragraphs to this, but it's clear that there's a sense of frustration, I guess, around these standards and what they may or may not be doing for kids' education.
Well, I do have some frustration
with
them,
I thought
write the book and only write about the feeling of doubt or dissatisfaction with say the Common Core standards when it occurred to you in the middle of a school day. That was sort of the working premise I was operating on. Let the thoughts bubble up in the midst of this incredible and actually thrilling life of a classroom, this tropical kind of terrarium that I happen to have to be privileged enough to be a part of. So I do have I don't know why kids are forced to learn the six layers of the atmosphere. I think it's an interesting topic, but there are a zillion interesting topics. It's sort of like they need some kind of locked down set, small finite set of topics that are testable, that have complicated, gnarly vocabulary words. You know, and words are good and they're fine. I deal in words every day, but testing people for their knowledge and ability to define vocabulary words doesn't get at a lot of the kind of intelligence that people really have. They're people who can take apart and put together motors, who know everything about dress designs, all sorts of skills and knowledge that don't get celebrated or paid attention to when it's the test is on. They must know the six, whatever number of layers there is, or the plant kingdom and the list of the different scientific kingdoms. And oh my God, it was just, and so as a substitute, I thought, why am I pushing this stuff on people? Why is this the Common Core, or is this just an arbitrary kind of picnic basket of stuff that will fill people's days with testable information?
And and this is not central to the book, and I don't want to get the show to turn into a debate about Common Core. We do that another day. But there are, it was only to illustrate that there are points in the book where your opinion comes up. There's also there are when kids are talking about, for example, behavior medications for ADHD.
Yeah.
You're pretty clear about your doubts about that.
Well, I mean, I of course was something of a skeptic before. I don't think kids should be given powerful antipsychotic drugs, and I thought that before I went into it. But I did run into kids who were taking very high doses of drugs and were then being put into remedial math classes because basically they couldn't think straight. The drug was forcing them to fail. And that was something that just, there was one kid in particular I was really worried about. I don't see that this was necessary. So I just sort of, what I tried to do was respect the moment. Where, how was this kid actually describing his life to me? And then find out, is this maybe the best use of his time?
Yeah. You focus primarily here on the students. They're the stars of your show here and the mm-hmm. focus of your interest. Mm-hmm. What did you learn, though, about teachers or administrators that maybe surprised you that you didn't know?
Well, I very much respected the teachers. There are different kinds of talents that you have to have to be a teacher, and one of them is if you're a man, and you don't have a certain kind of charisma, you have to have an incredibly loud voice. I mean, you have to have an iron larynx, and some of those guys really did. And they managed to get information across, and I was amazed by how loud their voice could be all day long. There was a robotics teacher and a social studies teacher. But they're also teachers, not men, who were able to control a class by these subtle forces that were almost... I didn't actually know what they were doing because there was a sort of tone of voice. It was just a little nudge. I don't know, I was talking about canoeing earlier, but it's sort of like when you're in a boat with somebody who knows how to get around, and it's just a little nudge here, and the class can move forward, and there is a certain buzz of disorder underneath, but mainly the kids are getting something done. It's impressive, and... You know, I don't know how people can do this year after year. I would think that you would burn out after 5 years, but there's some kids teachers who have been doing it for 20 years. And I really have to say, we've got to give more respect and money to these people because they are really knocking themselves out.
On the line with us now is Jim Politis. He's president of the National Substitute Teachers Alliance, and he is based in Maryland. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Welcome.
So your organization's slogan is Standing Up for Stand-In Educators. Why do substitutes need standing up for?
Well, I would say in a nutshell that we stand up for them because nobody else does, often not even themselves. Substitute teachers are sometimes retired teachers, others sometimes aspirant teachers. And sometimes there are folks who are trying to make a couple of bucks while they're between jobs. And if they do a good job, and mostly they do, they do an important job and a thankless job.
Is the issue, though, primarily about money, or are there other forms of appreciation that you would like to see shown?
I would say it goes beyond appreciation. I would say it's to the level of courtesy, sometimes even acknowledgement. I have not often and not recently, but when I first started substituting, I had one day when I went into a school and I said good morning to the secretary. And later on that day when I left, I said good afternoon to the secretary. And that was the last time I spoke to an adult all day.
Right. So is there an effort to elevate this position of substitute teaching in some way, or what is it, I guess, that you would like to see?
Yeah, I would say to elevate it. We, as substitute teachers, are aware that we don't have the burdens that the contracted teacher has, who's responsible for planning the lessons every day and responsible for assuring that the curriculum gets taught. But the classroom teacher doesn't have the experience or the burden of coming into what may be a totally new environment. and with very little notice, maybe hours, have to prepare themselves to teach a group of students a lesson plan that they perhaps have seen for the first time 20 minutes before, and carry that off with some degree of facility and as your guest on the air there said, get things done.
You had heard maybe, I'm not sure if you were on the line, during the discussion about the shortage of substitute teachers here in Maine, but is there a shortage nationally as well?
Yes. Well, let me say that there is a factor dealing with the economy. In my particular jurisdiction, and I understand that this was pretty common nationwide, during the recession, there were a lot of folks with bachelor's and a master's degrees and even some PhDs who were out of work, and they were looking for something to pay the rent with. And so there was a temporary glut of substitute teachers, of people who had applied for the positions. And to the extent that my school district, Montgomery County, Maryland, was not accepting any more applications for substitute teachers, that time has passed.
Sure.
Now there's a shortage.
All right. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. Jim Politis is president of the National Substitute Teachers Alliance. We're going to take another short break here, but first, a look ahead at tomorrow's show. Join host Jennifer Rooks for a conversation about helping baby boomers get started on a second career. Some seek a new career because they want a new challenge or to pursue a lifelong interest. Others feel trapped in their current position and want to change. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainpublic.org. Tweet us or post to the Facebook Maine Calling Facebook page. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Local 188, serving farm-to-table Spanish cuisine since 1999, located in Portland's West End and online at local188.com.
Angelina Jolie's new film is based on a memoir about a young girl who survived the brutal Khmer Rouge regime in 1970s Cambodia.
It was through that book that I really understood what had happened, and I was drawn to the way that she'd written it through the experience of a little girl.
I'm Kelly McEvers. Angelina Jolie's new film, First They Killed My Father, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And All Things Considered, weekday evenings from 4 to 6:30. And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for Alternative Radio. Today's speaker, public school teacher and author Jonathan Kozel. He's author of Death at an Early Age, which won the National Book Award. Alternative Radio coming up after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, substitute teachers and their role in public education. Joining me today, Nicholson Baker. He's an award-winning author who worked as a substitute teacher in Maine schools and then wrote about his experience in his book, Substitute, Going to School with 1,000 Kids. Join our conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to the phones to Eliza in Appleton. Hi, Eliza.
Hi, Keith. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make a comment as a person who attempted to be a substitute with no prior knowledge of what it entailed. And then later, after working elsewhere for quite some number of years, actually worked in public schools in the elementary and middle school level for 5 years. And after retiring, went back to substitute teaching. And with that perspective, I just wanted to mention that I think with a shortage in Maine and perhaps nationally, something that would be really helpful is a short training course. And I know some of those do exist, but a short training course on really what to expect as a substitute, because as the prior caller just mentioned, given sometimes as little as 20 minutes or half an hour to figure out what order the attendance and lunch menu orders need to be taken, and then what the order of subjects is for the day. One has scant little time to figure out a lesson plan, much less anything to do with classroom management. And I think in addition to some sort of short training course, and it could be something that is, 20 to 30 hours long. It also behooves the state of Maine and other states to pay our substitutes more. I stopped substituting completely when the pay was $70 a day, and it just wasn't worth my time to sometimes drive as much as 20 to 35 miles to be a substitute for a group of students I didn't know, and to come home with $70 for the day.
Yeah.
So I think we need to pay people better, and we need to help them learn what to do.
All right, Eliza, thank you. Nick, what about the pay thing we've talked about a little bit, but the preparation part? You talked about that in your book, the short course you took there. Mm-hmm. Was that enough?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it was a very good course, but the fact is that a lot of what you're going to have to learn, you're going to have to learn by being in the class and making mistakes. And I talked to so many teachers, not substitute teachers, but real credentialed teachers who would say, nothing that I learned in when I was getting my teaching certificate in college helped me in the class. I learn everything I know about college from being in the classroom. It's this bizarre thing that this is, you have to figure out what works by being in this maelstrom of youthful activity. There's no other substitute for that. So
let's go to Bob in Mount Vernon. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Hi. I've been a high school substitute teacher at a local high school for 15 years. I find it helps if you become a part of the community, if you can show up often enough so people recognize you.
Yeah.
And as a substitute, my opinion is, first, you're a head counter, second, you're a peacekeeper, and third, you're a teacher. And you can't restrict yourself to teaching all subjects you have a mastery of. You have to kind of fall in love with the company you're keeping. You have to truly respect and like the company of teenagers, and I do.
All right, Bob, thank you. You taught a range of courses and right. grade levels and yes. ages. You declined gym, but was there one that was the most challenging?
Well, the ones the ages that I was afraid of were kindergarten, first grade, second grade, because I thought these are the mysterious, tiny little people, and actually it makes a difference because that's where people are learning the one talent, the one skill that is going to be important in this country above all else, which is the ability to read. So that the stakes are very high. So I was nervous about those years. I didn't want to do gym because gym was just running in circles, listening to Happy by Pharrell Williams, and it was a sweaty, horrible thing. But in the end, I did have to clean up some throw up in the so I was part of that gym class. I just wasn't the official substitute teacher. But kindergarten terrified me, and I thought, I can't do it. I told the woman who called me up at 5:30 in the morning, we want you to be a kindergarten teacher. I said, I just don't think I'd be able to. And she said, you're going to love it. Just do it. This is the great thing, and this is why I think everybody who has any interest in education, somebody was talking about this earlier. I think you were. This is the one thing that you can do, the quickest route to some sort of personal wisdom about this whole knotty problem of what to do with American education is go into a class as a guest, as a person who is not part of things, and try to make it work and see what you learn. What an enormous privilege that is to be able to do that. And the great thing about being a substitute is that one day it's third grade, and then the next day it's middle school, and then the next day it's a remedial class, and then the next day you're talking with some hot shots in high school. So it's just all over the place. All of these ages have different sort of combustion points and different ways of being bad, different ways of being good. Each class is a little world, a snow globe of individual personalities, and so you learn something every single day. There's no other job that is such a challenging thing where it's like being one of those stand-up comics that has to go out and sort of improvise, right? You have to improvise every day. That's fun. And yes, it's true. It's very low paid, but it is no other way are you going to be able to listen to really interesting kids talk all day long and make your life miserable at the same time.
At one point in the book, you talk about at the end of a day feeling overwhelmed, yeah. And you couldn't identify the emotion, but it was pretty intense, but you just had a hard time, whether it was joy or frustration or sadness, right, or whatever. Talk about that. And is that a reflection of what you just said?
I think it is. I think that what happens, what you're doing when you are asked to be in a position of authority that you do not deserve. Obviously, a substitute teacher does not deserve to be in charge of a class because they don't know the material usually and they don't know the rules and all that. But it kind of gets a crowbar deep into your self, because what the guy said who just called, you have to have a kind of loving feeling towards these people, and you will love them, and because they are so complicated and they are working so hard to try to find a path through this wilderness and make it work. It is both funny and, you know, kind of in a light way entertaining, but then it gets you, suddenly you realize, you know, that somebody, for instance, is so not happy that he actually climbs in the cabinet in the back of the room and tries to close the door on himself, and his little white fingers are all you see, his little white fingers holding the door while people try to pry the door open. There are all levels of happiness and unhappiness that are sort of going along in parallel at any given moment. So by the end of the day, you've lived a Tolstoy novel, you know, in a space of some hours.
There's only about a minute left here. But against this notion that when a sub comes, the kids all figure out ways that they can make that person miserable and mm-hmm. somehow enjoy that, you found a lot of examples of kids who were genuinely concerned about you, wanted to make sure you were doing okay and wanted to help you and would give you tips on, you know, it might be time to order lunch now.
Yes, so often a person would know. And then one kid came up to me and I said, I have two words for you. Good luck. You know, and it just knowing what I am in for, knowing that he was in fact part of the problem, but also just so many kids who would come up to me and say, you forgot that what is sun butter? You know, what is all these things? They want to explain. They know the class better than I do. So they're always willing to explain and help out. They were all nice kids. Even the ones who were really difficult kids were nice kids.
And that's, again, because they were being difficult for a reason that you may or may not have any knowledge of. And while I guess I'm wondering, again, with 30 seconds left here, you want to be able to empathize with them, to care about them, but you can't be their friend. You can't be emotionally overly connected with all of them.
You can't, but you can't help it. I mean, some people you just think, well, you know, that you're dealing with something here that is too painful. Somebody's suddenly said, my father died, you know, or some huge fact in this kid's life that nobody else has been thinking about. What are you going to, well, I just, what I tried to do was talk to each person, each kid I could possibly, as if I was in a one-on-one conversation with that person and nobody else was around. Just sort of create a little state, a temporary state of affairs in which an actual human interchange of ideas was happening.
Right, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nicholson Baker is an award-winning novelist and nonfiction writer known for books such as Double Fold and House of Holes. His book Substitute recently came out in paperback. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today, and we had production help from John Keimel. Dan Plummer took your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Second Acts for the Baby Boomers, Finding New Career Directions Later in Life. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.